we have very little initiation, very little ceremony around this huge thing that happens in our life, which, as you so beautifully call, the changing of the guard. And I think one of the most beautiful things and one of the most loving things we can do is show up to the parent who may be ill, who may be dying, to face them in this moment exactly as they are. It's like, because there is an arrow of suffering, which is the reality that they are going to die. But the second arrow of suffering, in pretending that they're somewhere they're not, in pretending that we've had time to do things that we won't, in pretending that our relationship was something different than it was, is this unnecessary arrow of suffering on an already tender and often painful situation. So I always encourage people, as best they can, to see these loved ones in this transition process with fresh new eyes. Like the eyes of a child, the eyes of that this parent has been cleansed and born anew, and how much grace we can give them in that place, because we hold so many decades of burdens. And they do as well. And the most loving thing we can try and do is open to the fact that something new can happen right in this moment, right here.
Welcome to the Paris Hodges Podcast, a space for conversations rooted in curiosity of these divinely created bodies we've been given, and this human experience as a whole. This is a space where we will explore all the complexity and nuance of existing on this spinning rock, while I share story and dialogue with some individuals I consider to be great investigators of our bodies, many of which have had profound impact on my journey and understandings. I'm grateful you are here. Let's dive in. Greetings and hallucinations, friends. Welcome back to the Paris Hodges Podcast. Today, we are exploring a profound and often overlooked aspect of our existence: death work. Death work is intricately woven into the epigenetic makeup of women. We carry the duality of life and death simply in how we exist. Joining me today is the remarkable woman, Binyamina Aisha. Binyamina has dedicated her life to serving the mystery. With 20 years of experience, she's been a ceremonialist, a birth and death worker, an immersive artist, and a teacher of the spiritual and ecological experience. Her devotion lies in the holy wilderness found in land, spirit, and love. Binyamina guides alchemical group journeys, transformative retreats, and trainings in magical places. You might find her swimming in the ocean, singing worship music with arms wide open, or stewarding land and animals in the mountains of Utah. In this episode, we cover a wide range of topics, including Binyamina's legacy of death work, the importance of death work and why it's crucial for our growth, how the full spectrum of womanhood requires us to be death workers, the healing power of seeing your loved ones through fresh eyes, which can heal generations, navigating the challenges of tending to children during seasons of grief, addressing how death-phobic culture is weaponized against men, and the significance of trusting a man as an act of death work. This conversation promises to be a journey into the heart of what it means to embrace the full spectrum of life and death. So let's dive in and uncover the transformative power of death work with Binyamina Aisha.
Wonderful. Welcome, Benyamina. It's so good to be here with you.
So good to be here with you, Paris.
I would love it if you would open up with sharing a little bit. Well, let me pause for a second. Actually, I just want to say how excited I am to have this conversation with you and record it. You are a woman that truly embodies just the words came to me earlier. I often describe myself as a multidisciplinary artist of life. And that is something that I see in you. Like, you are a woman full of so much wisdom and depth and just the multifaceted nature of what God has created us to be is something that I experience you as. And so I'm so excited for this conversation because I'm sure it's dance in all kinds of ethers.
Thank you for that reflection. It's been a journey through my life to be holding as many different kinds of medicine as I hold, and seeing you, a kindred spirit on the multifaceted path, is such a joy.
So good. Where I actually think I want to guide it is, I'm curious which one of your medicines is your favorite to really drop into and feel into?
Such a juicy question. I would say recently it's been like two spirals together. One of them is the spiral of death, and the other one is the spiral of love. And of course they dance together each and every moment. And I find that the more that I dive into the world of death and surrendering and letting go, the more open my heart is, the more broken open my heart is to truly feel and love and share and be honest in my desires. Those are the two that I've been surfing the waves with more recently.
So good. I think this will actually kind of lead us in perfectly. How did you get into death work? What initiated you into that?
So I've been working in death work ever since I was a child. My great grandmother was a death worker, as well as my grandmother, as well as my mother. And so it is a lineage that I carry from many generations of women in my family, which is the most beautiful gift that they could have given me. I bring them into my spaces and call upon them all the time with my students. And from an early age, that was normalized for me as a part of life and a part of the process that we go through as humans, as communities. And as I got older, I saw that that sadly doesn't exist for most people in this society, in this culture, in the States. And so then I wanted to ripple that out as much as I could. And that's why I do the work now, 20 years later, because I think it's so important that we remember. I always say that death work is a remembering. We all come from traditions where death was honored and revered. And when I'm teaching my students about anointing bodies at the hospital, I'm teaching them about the anointing of Christ. Like, we get to traverse these times and places and threads and hold them all together and remember the weavings to make a new tapestry. It's such a gift.
That's so beautiful. I love that you already went there with the remembrance. And then the part that I hear too is that reverence of the holding of life and how we meet each individual in that posture of service. Like what you were talking about around the anointing immediately, like I think about that, like washing of feet, and how do we really meet those moments that require so much respect?
Yeah, and I think that that's something that has been lost so much, the respect of elders and of elderhood. And what has happened when we've forgotten the gifts of our grandparents and parents and great grandparents. And so one of the things that I really want to teach people and share and model for others is that it is the deepest act of devotion to be by the side of the dying. And that doesn't mean that it's easy. It requires often a getting out of our own way, as some of the best things require us to do. But it is a place where if we can be of service, opening up as the channel from which God wants to flow, what an absolute gift we can give to so many that would not receive that anywhere else. You know, it's an isolating culture for people getting older and people dying, for so many. And so if you can be just one person that holds a hand, that brushes hair, that sings a song, that says a prayer, I truly believe that that is healing for them, obviously healing for us, but also healing for community, healing for those who never had that in their life. So we get to weave these threads. Again, I'm a weaver, so I talk about threads a lot. But we get to weave these threads, and it's time travel. I always tell people, when we show up in service, it's not just for the now, it's repairing so many past times where service wasn't accessible or possible.
There's so many, like, it's bringing forward so much from the last 4 months and like year, around the amending too, right? Like the part that we play for when that respect wasn't possible, even just in our own lifespan, where we get to turn back towards, and how much that act of grace and reverence. I'm just thinking about this from the part around writing out. I have a practice of writing my amends out, and I've done it to people who have passed, and it's like a literal seance that occurs, that where it, like, I really communicate with that individual from the other side, and like leave space of did I leave anything out? How can I fix this? Or what can I do to make this right? And that's
beautiful.
And like actually listening for what that request is. And then I get to carry a part of that, those people, like, with me now. And it's been such a beautiful experience. But to what I hear, and part of what you're bringing forward that comes up for me, is how much we hold reverence and space for the dying parts of one another through our own individual journeys of life, and not just at the end point, but how much being a woman requires us to be a death worker all the time.
Absolutely. That is such a beautiful way of putting it. I truly believe that the feminine experience is a constant death and rebirth for our entire lives, right? And especially going through the journey of menstruation, and the journey of pre and post menopause, and the journey of conception and pregnancy and miscarriage and abortion, and all of the things that are a part of this constant spiral of the life, death, life that we cannot escape, right? It's like we can't escape it on such a fundamental level, even though we may try. It is a strand of truth that is always there. It's inherently there. And, you know, I'll have clients that are in their 70s still deeply feeling their menstrual cycles, even though they're not bleeding anymore, right? It's like there is something so beautiful that it is woven into us even before birth, right? Even us in our grandmother's ovaries, that it's so deep within us. And I think a lot of that has been lost, especially for women. And that there is a reluctance and opening to, as you said, the fact that you're a death worker all the time throughout your life as a woman. That is the heartbreaking and beautiful reality of our experience.
You know, what I think of when you talk about that too, or as this is being woven, is like the sisterhood wound, and how much really being in deep relationship with other women it is a requirement to be a death worker, to stand at the bedside of that woman as she traverses, like you so beautifully said, like into Minarch, in through the maiden journey, into that initiation of motherhood, and all of the parts of the woman that gets left behind. And how do we hold reverence for that journey with one another, and like bob and weave back and forth, right? Like, because that is something that we have to do, is hold the frame and then, you know, really be fluid.
Absolutely. And I feel like the sisterhood wound is so strong and deep for so many women. And what ends up happening is that we aren't held, and we also don't have access to the gift of holding. And so it is an isolated experience that so many women go through, which, again, if we're looking back in Indigenous culture, if we're looking back in the Bible, it's like women were doing this together. It was never meant to be alone. And I always say, whether it's, you know, teaching my death work students or, you know, working with someone on conception, we're not meant to do this alone. I truly, deeply believe that all of this work that we are all here to do is meant to be done in community. And that, especially for women, it is a muscle that most of us have to grow and work to be able to hold space and see ourselves in the other, which isn't always comfortable. And it's really important.
Yeah. I just read a quote that said that sometimes the mirror can be really sharp if it's broken.
Ooh, I love that.
It's a big one to hold that level of responsibility in relationship.
Absolutely. And I think that there has been so much attention placed on ourselves. And we live in a culture, especially an online culture, of just so much attention placed on ourselves, that we lose the opportunity to really see the other as a gift. And instead, we see the other as competition. We see the other as something to fear. We see the other as something to push away, instead of leaning in. What can I learn about myself here? How can I be more of service to this sacred third thing that's being created between us? Because there always is that sacred, secret third thing, as Jung likes to say. And it's not just between a man and a woman for husbandry, right? It's like, it is also between sisters. It's also between, you know, mother and daughter. It's also between father and son. But really being open to what is being created in this space of two, because it can be something truly holy. I deeply believe that.
I love the way you say that, because I think about, like, just you and I were talking before we hit record about the experience that Grace and I are dancing through together right now, of walking very parallel worlds of, this is might be where the tears come, of walking through parallel worlds of the possibility of losing the matriarchs of our family, and how I'm going through a metamorphosis and he's going through his own metamorphosis. And so we're like, every week we come back together, we have to re-meet one another, and how much that, even that process is, how much death can I be with?
Yes.
Because I have to, as a mother, let go of who it is that I believe my son is, who it, like, the expectation that I have around him as that umbilical cord gets, like, further and further away.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that it's like that constant greeting of the death. It's like over and over, and the pieces that are falling away and the pieces that are no longer there and will never be there again, because that is the inherent trajectory of the child coming into their own, and especially working with grief and working with all of these things that are catalysts for a child to open to the world, whether it was planned or not. But I think that is, especially for the mother, like, coming face to face with the death over and over again, and then greeting the child, oh, here you are in this new spot, and I'm going to have to grieve this spot too. And then I have to grieve the next and the next, and it never ends. I remember I was talking to my mom a couple days ago, and there were some storms where we are, and she texted me, and I hadn't gotten the text until later. So I texted her back later, and she said, you know, it was really hard for me not to call after not getting your text, but I'm also realizing that it's a part of just letting go. Like, you are this grown woman, and 20 years ago, I may have kept trying to get a hold of you. And now I need to take a step back and trust that you aren't 20-year-old you, right? You're almost 40-year-old you. And so even decades later, we're doing that dance, you know, as parents, as children, and saying goodbye. And it's on the flip side too, right? As children seeing our parents get older, that is a constant greeting of death and a grieving of what was, right? That our parent may not be the same energetic of parent from 5 years ago, and that next year they won't be of this moment. And what a constant discovery and confronting of reality. And that can be beautiful, and it can be heartbreaking. And you'll hear that I say those two words together all the time.
Yeah. It's what you said too about the reorientation to our parents. Like, this is something that I've really been in a deep walk with. Anyone who follows me on social media and kind of understands at least a surface level of what's been occurring in my world. And a lot of, I've walked through those initiations of the little girl being super activated and wanting to jump in and be like, you guys can't do any of this. You can't do this on the own, your own. I need to jump in and throw myself in front of this avalanche that's occurring that can't stop. And it got to that point where I was in a spiral yesterday, and I needed to just pick up the phone and call and be like, and cry, like that, like cry out of like, I need my mom. Didn't expect all of this, but
yeah, you know, I have been in a current spot that's very similar. My dad's just health is not great, and I constantly find myself being like, I need to intervene more. I need to control it more. I need to fix it. I need to be the one that bears the brunt of it all the time. And one of the deaths that I continue having to face is, that's not my role. As much as I want to step in and have that be my role, that's not actually the role that God wants for me. And that can be incredibly painful. And like you said, I called my dad a couple days ago and was just like, I miss my dad. I want my dad here. And no matter how old we are, that meeting and greeting of death, of decay, of disintegration is incredibly challenging. And I try and remind myself as best I can that there's also something else being birthed in so profoundly in that same experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't always remember, but I try.
It is a practice. That's been one of the really beautiful gifts of this season, is the rebirthing of the relationship from the shifting of my perception of the version of my parents from, you know, the developmentally natural part that we, many of us go through of the scale of grief, of going through the indignant self-righteous anger and like processing all of that, and then coming to the realize like, oh, wait a second, I'm literally exactly what my parents were doing and were probably trying the best they could. You know, like all of those things where that sense of entitlement of not getting, I didn't get X, Y, and Z, so my parents were wrong, you know, that we have to process and let go of and then meet them compassionately in that sunset season of life. And I'm curious, Benjamina, if you have advice, because I know that I have a felt sense that a lot of people who are listening are have either danced and woven in to the loss of that initiation of the changing of the guards, the losing of our matriarchy and patriarchy, and what that, how we can meet that with a lot more respect.
That's such a beautiful question. It's such an important question because we have very little initiation, very little ceremony around this huge thing that happens in our life, which, as you so beautifully call, the changing of the guard. And I think one of the most beautiful things and one of the most loving things we can do is show up to the parent who may be ill, who may be dying, to face them in this moment exactly as they are. It's like, because there is an arrow of suffering, which is the reality that they are going to die. But the second arrow of suffering, in pretending that they're somewhere they're not, in pretending that we've had time to do things that we won't, in pretending that our relationship was something different than it was, is this unnecessary arrow of suffering on an already tender and often painful situation. So I always encourage people as best they can to see these loved ones in this transition process with fresh new eyes. Like the eyes of a child, the eyes of that this parent has been cleansed and born anew, and how much grace we can give them in that place, because we hold so many decades of burdens, and they do as well. And the most loving thing we can try and do is open to the fact that something new can happen right in this moment, right here. I remember the last time I saw my dad at the hospital, I was coming in hot. I was about ready to be like really controlling. I was angry about things. I wanted to micromanage. And then I opened the door a little bit and I saw him there just like a child. He's just like a child, scared, feeling lonely. And all of that was able to be melted away. And I was able to show up to him just as he was. And that meant that it looked very different than what I thought my dad should be or would be. And that's the most loving thing we can do. And I'll say that from my experience and experience with my clients, the more we give grace to this process of changing the guards, the more we will give grace to ourselves as we go through the same years later. And the more we can remember, oh, I was in that spot too. How can I love the imperfection even here? Even here, how about now? That is the continual practice that I am always inviting into my life. And I think that's one of the most beautiful places that death work can bloom, in a place of forgiveness, in a place of being willing to start over. It's like even the simple act of, if you're in a fight with a partner and it's like, can we have a do-over? It's like, it's such a tender thing to actually say, let's start anew here. And it's courageous. It takes courage. And then we are actually showing up with the person face to face, exactly who they are, without projection, without burden, without anger or entitlement. What an incredible gift to give someone who is, you know, on their way to pass.
What I hear in that too, that I love that you touched on, is that ability for us to like pick up our cross and to die unto ourselves daily, like within that. And how much too, just to speak to my own experience of that, like bob and weave of through all of the eons of time, right? Like how we meet those moments of compassion, of seeing them through the eyes of compassion, so that we can one day meet that same moment. Just like, I mean, that is what I'm being like shaken by right now. in this season of having watched my mom lose her mom and how much that really crushed her. Because she was an only child, right? That was a big burden to carry. Well, she wasn't, at that point in time, she was the only child present. And her father had already passed too. So she was carrying all of that herself. And how isolating and alone she must have felt. And how confusing it was for me as a child. Which is the part that I dropped into this last weekend of really coming to and waking up and being like, okay, that's right. Grayson is like that version of me who couldn't process the loss of her best friend at that same age. And how, you know, I've been brought through the resurrection of my relationship with my parents, and how it's like, I finally get to that place of love, and it's like, no, I want you to live. You can't go yet. Like, that's not fair.
Of course. I have many moments of it's not fair. And I think that it is made even more potent, and in some ways even more painful, when we are able to go through, as you say, like the resurrection with our parents, with whoever is passing. You know, I had a client who had a very challenging marriage with her husband for many years. And at the end, there was this opening for grace and for amends and for a starting over, a rebirth. And she admitted to me, it made it more painful, right? Because it was just like, I want to keep this with me as long as possible. And so I find those spots where, and I think we all do this, whether in death or not, of the pushing away makes the pain more distant, right? And so we can push away and we can make other and we can make wrong and we can have our protectors up and the walls of defense super strong. And wow, we miss out on so much raw, tender love. And there's a reason why in death work we say that love and grief are two wings of the same bird. It's like they are meant to be together. And I truly believe that the more we can open ourselves up to, okay, I'm going to be here in this passing, whether it happens a year from now or tomorrow, I'm not going to go away. It breaks our hearts open to more love than we could ever imagine.
Yeah. I'm curious, for those individuals that really have a challenging time with death, that might have experienced some sort of trauma behind it or whatever the reason is that like turning towards is so hard, do you have any suggestions or practices, like one, maybe like just one, like one practice, one tool to really help support that being able to turn towards?
That's such a great question. Yeah, a lot of people will come to me, and I mean, the terror of death is very real. And like you said, especially if people who have had traumatic death, if people who have had loss at a young age and who did not have the capacity or the resources to process and to be with it. And one of the things I always say, because I love internal family systems and I work with IFS a lot, is to notice the place in us that turns away from death and to simply spend time with it. It's a part that's protecting us. And instead of trying to push it aside to get into the like, but let's confront it right this moment, a lot of people actually need time with the protector first. The protector feels like it's not safe to confront death. The protector feels like our lives are in danger if we confront death. There's so much deep fear within the system. So one of the things when I'm working with people who have a lot of terror around death is, first and foremost, let's start journaling about this protector. the one who does not want to see, the one who looks away, the one who is terrified, the one who cannot sit with the reality that everyone we love will die someday. And to really spend time with that part so it feels heard and listened to. Otherwise, it's very hard for that part to soften and allow us to start dipping our toes into the water. Mm. I always tell people it is a low and slow process. For us to be, especially so many of us in this culture and society, to be surrounded in a death-phobic culture, it is no wonder so many people have so much resistance to death. And so we get to then spend time with this protector for as long as it takes. Sometimes people are terrified of death and spend, you know, a few weeks working with this protector and they're ready to dive in. And sometimes it takes years to actually speak the thing out loud. My mom's going to die. That can take years for someone to say. So we all have our natural timing. And I always encourage people to just be patient, be gentle with themselves, and really start to open to, what is this part trying to shield me from? How can I start caring for my own internal safety so that this part feels like it doesn't have to work so hard?
I got to do some of this work with one of your brilliant students. So it feels very, I love that part, because that is the part that gets the loudest and will collapse a body too. That protector part, at least for me in my experience, if that protector is not like asked what it wants to contribute to the conversation, it'll
make it out.
Yeah, mine has tried.
Mine too.
Good. And how would you suggest that parents speak to children through these big seasons too? And do you have any advice of how they can best meet those moments to help support them?
I think that's so important to address. I was just talking about this in the death worker training that's currently going on, that so often parents try to shield their children from death. And I have seen through my decades of doing this work how that is not beneficial to the child, and especially in the long term. It is a part of, you know, as Glennon Melton says, the brutiful, which is the brutal and the beautiful. It's like the brutiful reality of the human experience. And I would say that so many families I work with, the parents are trying to actively shield the child in the well-intentioned hope that then the child won't suffer. But the child is suffering, and then they're just suffering alone. So one of the first things I always teach and talk about with parents is acknowledge the elephant in the room, right? It's like, your grandma is dying. Let's be with how that feels for you. What are the emotions that come up for you? Are there confusing emotions? They may be relieved because she's been in a lot of pain, but they feel scared to say that. Oh, they're only allowed to be sad. They're not allowed to be angry. So it's really an encouraging full permission for them to have the unique experience that they are supposed to have. Why do we allow adults that, but we don't allow our children to have that same thing? And I feel that I truly feel like the alchemy of grief is able to so much easier. It's so much easier to flow through a child when it's actually being acknowledged and spoken and worked with. I've seen the progression of that grief spiral happen so easily and smoothly and efficiently versus the compression, the denial, the trying to save. And anytime we're trying to save someone, it doesn't work anyway, right? It's like, spoiler alert, that doesn't work. And I think one of the most important things that parents can offer is the sovereignty and autonomy of the child getting to have their own experience.
Yeah. Mm. This is potent, good medicine. And I'm just thinking about like how I've witnessed like my nieces and nephews and like watching Grayson too traverse this season. And I will say one of the things as an individual, because my comfort zone is the dead place. Like I love to go into the abyss. Pisces, 12th house Pisces, Cancer moon, like give me splayed open.
Give me all of it.
I don't know if I've ever shared with you too. I'm a nine numerology. I'm a nine life path. Like I am like, give me death. But so coming out of death is actually a really big experience for me to come into the top side world and turn back towards joy and love and like get out of the negative thought loops. And the thing that I've learned too is creating little playgrounds for us and experiences to invite him into also, like if he so chooses, you know, not like forcing anything to come and like play and like. And I need that for myself also. And he and I negotiating, like, what are your needs? What are your needs like during this without like totally trying to like chip away at marble?
Right. I love that. It reminds me that one of the most important parts of parents holding grief for the child is for them to see that it's okay to have grief and then resurface, right? And it's like, it's something that's not going to consume them. And so then we get to model, okay, here's this space where we are deep in this grief. And also we get to then play deep in this joy. And so then they get to see it's safe to be titrating. You know, we don't have to shun one to be forever in the other. But that's a practice and a process. And, you know, we as adults are always learning that for ourselves. And the more that we can experience that and model that to children, the more they can see, oh, we get to be in both of these realms. Both of these realms are important to our experience as a human being.
So good. I would love to hear too about what it is, like the medicine of love, like to pull us out of the the underworld and let's come, not that the underworld isn't like gilded with love, but
sure. just a different flavor of it. You know, I, in a class a couple days ago, one of the questions that I asked is what my students were devoted to. We were talking about really facing death and what you would be missing and what you would be grieving as you pass on. And there were really beautiful, beautiful responses. And my response was love. And when I'm talking about it in that sense, I'm talking about the tangible material manifestation of a beloved. And that for me is a huge orienting principle of my life. And I think that as I often share on Instagram, I will share about love and specifically adoration of my husband, love for men and what they do for our community and culture and society. And it's probably the thing I post about that I get the most trolls.
Really?
100%. Every time. Every time. And so simply the act of me stating in a story, or especially if it's in a post, devotion to a man, adoration of my husband, gratitude for the masculine and the template in which they hold and provide for us. Oh my goodness. People come out of the woodwork I didn't even know were there. And it is so confronting. It is so triggering. And a part of me understands that. And I feel like that is a place where God is continually inviting me and requiring me to be as open and honest and direct and as clear as possible. That for me, it is not a an afterthought. It's not a invalidation of my gifts to the world if one of my orientations is a sacred union. But we have gotten to a place in society where it's almost like you can't even say that, especially in some circles, you definitely can't say that, right? And we're seeing that shift. We're seeing the adoration and the respect of men and the masculine coming back. And that's still a place that is so deeply wounded, that we as women can't access love within our own hearts because we are carrying the burdens of decades of man-hating.
And how much that's tied to the deathophobic culture that we exist in. That's the part that, like, you know, gets illuminated for me in that share around, like, of course they're activated. They're not in right relationship with maleness that hungers for war, for fighting and for death. Like, they're the hunters, right? And we have this world that's like erupted in this hunger for veganism or vegetarian, right? Like, no, the cows are what's killing the environment and all of, like, let's not harvest food like we are intended to. And so it's created that it makes sense to me then that devotion and adoration to somebody who, like, is rightful in their full expression of a man would be so activating to, like, the field that all of a sudden all the things get.
It really, I love the way that you wove those two together, because it is this death phobia that trickles into even the way that we perceive the masculine. And if we can't see the inherent archetypal energetic within the masculine of war and of death and of violence, it's like we're not even allowed to say those things, right? So instead, we make them wrong. We make them the bad guy. We demonize men. We demonize. And how many times do we see, I'm putting this in quotes, toxic masculinity, right? It's like that is even what so many people refer to as masculinity now. I hear toxic masculinity just as much as I do masculinity by itself. And I think it is this inability to really be with the gift of those archetypal energies, which is not softness. And it's not gentleness. It may not be. It may be fierce and penetrating and a Martian quality, which we are so triggered and terrified of. I was recently watching this series on Netflix called Quarterback, I think is what it's called. And it's about three of the main quarterbacks in the NFL. And I was so taken aback by the role of service that they occupy. That here are these three men who have taken on the role of war for us and get TBI, receive so much physical injury, so much stress upon their life, but show up and take this rightful role of warrior. And we all get to enjoy that and soak in the archetypal medicine of that natural rightness of the role of men. And I was moved to tears. That wasn't, I don't think, the point of the show, but it was incredibly moving to me, right? And it's like, but what do a lot of people say, that the football players are dumb or the football players, you know, it's like such an invalidation and a minimizing of the life, death, life cycle, that it can't just be the feminine providing this softness and this creation all the time, that the destroyer, the renewer, the resurrector has to come in order for us to create anything new. And I think that that's one of the things that has happened with picking and choosing the pieces of love or the pieces of men that we like and throwing away the parts that we don't.
Yeah, there's a part too that I'm curious how much our inability to hold death and then weaponize that against men actually triggers even more of that aggression to come out, where it's like the unintended consequences of, like, every time you try and, like, you know, squash this, that it brings it out even more. And I've watched this in the world of recovery a lot too, of how I started to catch it from men I came in contact with, that I would ask them, like, these were individuals that ended up being incarcerated for long periods of time, that had, you know, gone, found their tribe out in the world, right, to help them go to war in whatever capacity it was. And I asked the two different men, two very different ends of the spectrum, both experiencing, like, very parallel worlds, because their mothers would not let them become, go into the army or go become a Navy SEAL.
Yes. I'm so glad you brought that up. I think that is one of the parts that is so sad to watch the cycle, because it is perpetuating the cycle of what then the feminine demonizes. If we are not allowing a outlet for this inherent natural right energy to be coursing through the body of the mortal man, we can't be shocked if it then comes out in ways that are not skillful. And so here we are in this place where it's like, oh no, any type of that aggression is terrifying. You know, I, again, bringing it back to football, and I'm not even a football person, but how many memes I saw about Travis Kelce in the face of his coach yelling. And the next day, there were so many women posting, I don't think Taylor Swift is safe in this relationship. I can't believe that this, you know, entitled little boy is having a temper tantrum. I just saw and felt so much demonizing of this energy that is supposed to be running through the circuitry of the masculine and feminine energetic that we create. And so then, of course, it's going to find other ways to come out. And then we have huge populations of men who are incarcerated, who are made wrong for their entire lives, and then come out and carry the burden of being wrong and bad for the rest of existence, right? So it's like, how much pain, when I really feel into it, the men hold collectively and not even being able to be themselves. It's devastating to me.
So, there's so much there. There is so much there too. Even on the other side of how many men get drafted that don't want to be like that. I mean, we crave the safety of the posture of the humble warrior, right? But that's not, like, life is a full spectrum, and it's being able to meet those places with grace. That's why I'm so grateful that I was walked into the rooms of recovery that really taught me the true divine grace and what love really is, and seeing the pain that people are walked through, in that burden that you're talking about, where they exit the incarceral system and then they're plopped back in a world that's continued turning without them. And what does that, like, what groove do they fall back into? And how are they met in that process of, like, are you going to view them the same exact way, like, that you view this other person who's really, they're on equal footing, in a sense of, we all put our pants on the same way, and we really are trying the best we can. And some people just don't actually have the ability to utilize tools, or we've told them that they're wrong their entire life, so they're going to lash out again.
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things, I've worked with incarcerated men quite a lot, and when I had a private practice as a psychologist, and there were so many of my clients who had never been told, I love you. There were so many of my clients who wanted to kill themselves because they felt like a monster, and everyone and everything told them they were. So here we have this opportunity to, and as you say, it's one of the biggest gifts of the rooms, right? It's like we see the full spectrum of the human experience of life. And there's a possibility of opening to so much love there. So much love of seeing we are all struggling. We are all carrying burdens on this path. And I think that's one of the things we lose with virtue signaling is like, here are the people that deserve the love and grace. And here are the people who don't.
Mm-hmm.
That is definitely not the kind of world or life that I want to be living.
Yeah. I love that you brought up that how many of those individuals had never heard I love you. The other part that I'm curious about is how many of them had ever heard I trust you. Because this is a big one that I've learned even as a mom, like with Grayson, and then in my times of dipping my toes into the field of dating, I had an experience where I was sitting in the front seat with a gentleman who, like, he made choices in his driving, and like, I have learned, and my hands are not on the steering wheel, I'm not driving. And anyways, what unfolded was he was like, close your eyes, don't watch as I do this thing. And I just turned to him and I was like, I'm not driving the car. I trust you to get us wherever we're going because I trust that you understand what you have in your car. And I like, Benjamina, I felt it. I felt that moment of like, that hadn't been said before.
That's a life-changing moment for him. Because I think about how many men are never trusted and instead are over-controlled, micromanaged, infantilized, being told that they don't know what they're doing, that they're dangerous, that they're wrong. And instead, we have the possibility of opening to trust. And that it can be a hard pose to hold. And it is confronting to the parts of us that think we know better, that want to control the outcome. But one of the most beautiful things I've seen, either in my marriage or work with men that I've done throughout the years, has been that moment where a man truly feels your trust. It's like, I trust your insight here. I say that to my husband all the time. I trust your insight, period, full stop. Sometimes I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how it's going to go. And for me, it's like, that's part of reception. That's part of surrender that is so important to me in my life and in my relationship. But to think that that is something that's almost, you know, it's unfeminist to have that perspective. It's misogynist to have that perspective. It's harmful. All of the things that we hear from whatever communities we're in. Oh my gosh, if I was a man and I had not really felt the trust of a woman, I would be heartbroken. Heartbroken. I think that that is a role that we can occupy and are being asked to occupy.
And I will say, just to be mindful of time, and it's 4:44, that the part that I hear within that too is like our radical responsibility to anchor into trusting ourselves, which brings this all the way back to the death work, is that we need to be able to meet those moments where an ecosystem is going to change, where life will never be the same from this point on. And that is the death work. And it's the work of being a woman in a female body, that you are a different human every single day. And you have to make peace with that first and foremost, or you're going to walk around the world dropping bombs everywhere in every situation because you are so unwilling to let go of what you are grasping in your hands or carrying on your back as that, like that burden that you talked about, the burdens of centuries past. And like, are you willing to die into yourself and trust who?
Paris, that is so beautiful. That is so beautiful. One of the things is, you know, I'm also a midwife. So I'm holding birth and death together all the time. And I, many years ago, spoke at a midwife conference about birth control and death phobia together. And it's a perfect example, right? Of like us not being willing or open to face the ever changing, ever decaying, ever renewing reality of the female body. And so of course, if we do not have that trust in ourselves, how would we be able to trust a man? So first and foremost, it is that inside invitation of, I truly believe it is a gift as women to build the capacity of your own death worker for yourself. You are dueling your own death every day.
So good. And how do we also then rejoice in the rebirth every single day? It's like holding, can you hold both of those worlds and let go, even in seas of that feel like you're being plummeted by tsunamis? Because that's how you'll make it through. That's how you'll find that internal peace and serenity of knowing like this too is okay.
Yes. And I truly believe that both birth work and death work are this moment to moment practice of surrender. And if we truly open to surrender, that is the deepest knowing that we are okay. We are okay in this moment, even if it feels like we're going to die, even if it feels impossible, even if it feels like unbearable pain, we're going to be okay. And I feel like that deep felt sense in our body is something that so many are missing and something that we need to cultivate, right? It's like trust in ourselves and trust in the process is a cultivation. It doesn't happen overnight and it doesn't usually get dropped into our laps. It's something that we need to dip our toes into. And it's like, we can feel our edges around like, oh, our part that wants to control this outcome's coming in. Okay, that's good to know. I'll take a little bit of a step back. Okay, next time, maybe I'll push a little bit further. And so we get to do this dance with our parts and connecting to capital S self, which is, I'm going to be okay no matter what happens. If Jesus was okay with no matter what happens, we can be too.
I don't know. Somebody, I feel like my cross is a little big.
It's like a helpful reminder for me sometimes. I'm like, okay.
Good. That's a humbling, like, oh yes, that's right. I'm not, somebody can take me down from that cross I've nailed myself onto.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, so good. Oh, there's so many things that I wish, I mean, I could bob and weave for a really long time with you. There's things that we didn't get to, but I trust that this all is so perfect. Do you have any last words of wisdom to share with people who may be walking through seasons of grief?
Yeah, I would say, first and foremost, if you are one of those people that is walking through a season of grief and loss, to take your time. So many aspects of that process can be rushed, and that you get to take the time at your own pace to process, to navigate, to integrate the grief and how it is changing you, because it is changing you moment to moment. And what is being asked of you is to be with it bite by bite, step by step, not on anyone else's timeline, but on yours and on the divine timeline that flows through you.
So beautiful. If people have a desire to work with you and to meet all of your medicines, how may they find you?
Yes, so they can find me on Instagram under my name, Binyamina B. So that's Binyamina, Bee, like a bumblebee. And can I say something about two programs I have coming up?
Please.
So next program is called The Sacred Story, and it is a 6-week exploration of the Gnostic Gospels, which I'm really excited about. I've been wanting to do this like longer term exploration of the Gnostic Gospels for a long time. And it'll be wild and weird and creative and erotic and all the things. So that'll be late April. And then in late May, I'm having a retreat in Joshua Tree that is called Cloth of the Crossroads, and it's going to be a burial shroud making retreat. So it can be to make your own burial shroud, to make the burial shroud of a parent or a child or a partner, but it's going to be an incredibly potent, beautiful time in the death medicine of the desert to create this talisman that will bring you from one realm to the next.
So beautiful. Thank you so much for your time today and for sharing your gifts and your medicine. When you brought up that you're a midwife, I wanted to say, like, is there anything that you're not? Like,
I've lived many decades within this 38 years of mine. Thank you so much for having me, Paris. I adore you and your medicine. I feel so grateful that we've been woven into life together, and I look forward to more.
And there you have it. If you want to find more information about Binyamina's upcoming events, they are linked below in the show notes. And for all of the women listening, if you are interested in discovering more about the power of your menstrual cycles, I invite you to join me in my upcoming class, In Sync. It is a space and time where we will embark on a journey to uncover the divine rhythm of your menstrual cycle. It'll be held Thursday, March 28th from 3 to 4:30 p.m. Link down below to claim your seat. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. I hope it has inspired you to delve deeper into the mysteries of life and death, and to embrace the natural cycles that shape our existence. Until next time, keep being curious, friends.